Well, good morning. My name is Sean. I am one of your missionaries through M&A, that's Mission to North America, and I am a church planter in Metro Boston, Massachusetts. And you can tell by my accent, I was clearly born and raised in Boston. Okay, yes, that was a joke. You're supposed to laugh. Many of my neighbors do indeed park the car in Harvard Yard, and I don't. So I'm a Memphis boy. I was born in Memphis, went to high school in Germantown. For those of you who've been around a while you guys were still itinerant, I actually, 2005, 2006, preached for you several times. I remember preaching in a lecture hall at Union University. I remember preaching in a school cafeteria. Was that out at Trinity, maybe, I think? It's great to see you guys in a building now and to see where the Lord has taken us both in the 10, 12-ish years since then. Well, this morning we're going to be in Mark chapter 6. And we just read verses 1 through 13, and in a little while, we're going to finish up the passage by reading verses 14 through 29. I won't make you stand up or anything, but you want to keep your Bibles open as we kind of dip into this and refer to this text. And what I want us to do to get into this text is I want to ask this question. I want you to think of the last time that someone challenged you, someone contradicted you, or very popular where I am ministering right now, someone triggered you or even offended you. How'd you respond? Are you happy with how you handled it? Or do you wish you could kind of get a mulligan and try that one again, maybe? That's a daily occurrence for many of us, isn't it? And at this point in Mark's gospel, Jesus has actually had a lot of really good things happen. He's had a lot of very popular things, a lot of very positive responses. And now he's going to start to get into some challenges, some difficulties. And we're going to see how Jesus and those around Jesus deal with challenges and difficulties in life. This is a big text, in case you're sitting thinking, wow, 29 verses and they have a chair here, we better buckle up. No, we're not going to take that long to do this. So we can't cover everything. But what I want to do is I want to walk through this text together. And I want to do it with the concept of identity. And we're going to do that by asking three questions of this text. One, who is Jesus? Two, who are the disciples? And three, who is Herodias? Who we haven't talked about yet, but we'll get there. So, first question, who is Jesus? And the answer is, from this text, Jesus is who he says he is. Jesus leaves the thronging crowds of chapter 5, the popularity of chapter 5, and he shows up in his hometown. And verse 2 tells us that they are shocked at Jesus as he is teaching them. It's not a positive response. You know, when I became a Christian in my late teens, one of the things that really impacted me, one of the things that the Lord used to bring me to himself was how real and honest the Bible was. You know, people had flaws. We see here that Jesus had troubles. He was not always accepted with gladness. You know, and if you're making this stuff up, you only put the good stuff that happens to Jesus, right? You only put the positive spin. You don't show the other stuff. But the fact that the scriptures includes the bad stuff really made an impression on me that, you know, this stuff might have actually happened. This isn't just some polished PR job. And you really get to see this if you kind of dig into it. In verses 2 and 3, the English changes it, but in the original language, they don't say he and him. They purposely use the word this. So instead of for you English people, I know we have some people smarter than me, instead of a personal pronoun, they use a demonstrative pronoun. And just like in our day, it's an insult. Imagine people going, you talk to somebody and you're an expert. Like, who's this guy? Get a load of this. What does this guy think he is? See, but instead of, I'm not going to call you a person, I'm going to call you a thing. And it's an insult. And it's exactly what they do in verses 2 and 3. There's no he there in the original. It's all this and that. And in a patriarchal culture, they don't say, isn't this the son of Joseph? What do? It's the son of Mary. That's an insult in that culture on purpose. It's a backslap. It's kind of calling into question who is his dad. These are fighting words, as we would say in this part of the country. And then to top it off, they've insulted him, and yet what they are offended by him. The Greek word is actually scandalized by Jesus. This is not a good reception for Jesus. And how does he take it? What does Jesus do? He doesn't reject them. And the text reminds us, you know, since miracles confirm faith, Not a lot of faith here to confirm, so he doesn't do many miracles as opposed to other places. But he doesn't lash out as I would. He marvels at them. He wonders at them. He basically, you know, pulls out his phone and texts the Holy Spirit. Can you believe this reception? SMH. For those of you over 40, that means shake my head. It's like this. So find someone who's under 20. They'll translate for you. But here's what I want to do. He leaves to go to more receptive places, but I want to land on this. He has been rejected and insulted. He has the fortitude. He has the internal strength not to lash out, not to insult, not to reject back. And that is not easy. In our more candid moments, even on this time on a Sunday morning, we'll admit that is not easy. I mean, boys and girls, when someone is mean to you at school, when someone makes fun of you, you often want to be mean back, don't you? It's really tempting to be mean back. And you know what? When someone's mean to your parents, they feel the exact same way. Ask them at lunchtime today. They'll tell you. I was up shopping at a store in Boston up there, their version of Kroger. And I parked my car between these two SUVs. And I was starting to back out slowly because, I mean, it's a parking lot, not a highway, right? So I can't see. So I back out slowly. I get about a third of the way out. I still can't see. Someone honks at me. I'm like, okay, no problem. So I stop. They pull right behind me and then honk at me some more. And I start waving their finger at me. I mean, I was like, it's not like I jumped out. I was like easing out. And I was like, you know what? Fine. My car's paid for and I've got insurance. I put it in reverse and I floored it. And they had like peel rubber to get out of the way. And I thought, man, I'm like Jesus. And let's be candid here. I'm a professional Christian. How do you amateurs do a deal, huh? Yeah. See, that's not how Jesus reacts to challenges in life. That's not what he does. He has an internal strength when that junk happens. His identity is firm. He knows who he is. Verse 4, he says he is a prophet. Before this in chapter 5, Jesus has claimed to be the Messiah, the special rescuer that God has sent. Jesus even goes so far as to claim to be God himself. Now, you may not believe him when he says that, but Jesus believes that he has received an identity from God. And that identity empowers him. That identity anchors him to live well in the face of opposition. You know, especially where I'm ministering, we all want to be tolerant. We want to coexist. Equality is very important social value. And we see, wow, Jesus is actually able to live that way. Those aren't just words and platitudes to him. He can actually do it. So the question we have to ask ourselves throughout this text is, do we have an identity like Jesus does that gives us the strength to be the open and tolerant people we claim we want to be? Jesus does, because he is who he says he is. His identity is anchored and secure in something strong. So that's who Jesus is, who he says he is. So who are the disciples? Well, we'll see in this text, verses 7 through 13, that the disciples are who Jesus says they are. Jesus pairs up his disciples, and he sends them out on mission to the rest of the surrounding areas. Now, I want you to get this idea of what's happening here. So as I've moved to Boston, I've been there about 2 years now, I started noticing that, maybe you guys do it too, I'm just out of touch, the word bandwidth is used up there in a way that I had not heard it used before. It was bandwidth, like, okay, your internet, right? What's your bandwidth? Up there, it's very common in a meeting for someone to say, okay, we have to take on this project. Do you have the bandwidth to head this up? Okay, that's not a bad way to use that word, okay. And what's very interesting is if we could rewrite a Greek lexicon to make it into modern English, that word authority used there, Jesus gave them authority, the best vernacular translation would be bandwidth. That's what he does. He gives them the capacity, the competence, the ability, the bandwidth to do this mission. He gives them what they need. In other words, they are who he says they are. He says, you need this, there you go. Go do it. And did you notice this? For those of you who would call yourselves Christians in the room, did you notice this? He sends them out unprepared and unprovisioned. He just gives them the ability, the authority, the bandwidth. That teaches us something about our own efforts at evangelism, doesn't it? Now, I know you guys don't struggle with this, but many Christians I know, you know, they have this idea that we have to have all of our ducks in a row. I've got to have I have to have an answer to every possible objection they could raise, and then I can go out and talk to somebody. Oh, I better study some more. They may ask me, I don't know. But notice Jesus, he doesn't have them line everything up before he goes. He goes, man, just go. I've given you the authority. I've given you the ability. Just go mess stuff up. It's fine. It's okay to be unprepared and still be on mission if our identity is rooted in who Jesus says we are. If we recognize that it's not our skill, it's not our ability, it's not our likability, it's not how good we speak. Instead, it's having the bandwidth given from Jesus to be on mission and to have effectiveness. That's the identity Jesus gives his people, which is a little different from the modern identity of, you know, a comfortable life avoiding difficulty. So that's the disciples. We're going to come back to this in a second about who these disciples are. But for it all to make sense, we need to look at a character named Herodias in this text. So real quick, where have we been? Jesus is who he says he is. That identity gives him strength. The disciples are who Jesus says they are, and that gives them strength. And so now we're going to see, who is Herodias? Well, she is who she says she is. And we want to ask the question, does that give her strength? So if you'll turn, we're going to finish this text out, verses 14 through 29. You can remain seated. It says this. King Herod heard of it. This is the mission of Jesus sending out his disciples. For Jesus' name had become known. Some said, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. But others said, he is Elijah. And others says, he is a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I've beheaded, has been raised. For it was Herod who had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. But an opportunity came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his nobles and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. For when Herodias' daughter came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it to you. And he vowed to her, whatever you ask, I will give to you, up to half my kingdom. And she went out and said to her mother, for what should I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. And she came in immediately with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And the king was exceedingly sorry. But because of his oaths and his guests, he did not want to break his word to her. And immediately the king sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl. And the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard of it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. So the scene shifts. We have Jesus being rejected. We have his disciples being sent out, and notice Jesus tell them, you're probably going to be rejected. And then we have Herodias. And Mark puts this large chunk about the death of Jesus at John the Baptist right in between this mission. If you go on reading the text, he sends his disciples out. This chunk of John the Baptist comes in, and then his disciples report. It's almost like Mark got confused, you know, with the Control-C, Control-V on his little Mac there when he was putting this thing together, because it seems kind of haphazard. And if it is haphazard, why are we bothering? But if this text has been put together by an intelligence with a purpose, as it claims it is, then these narratives are connected. And so we need to ask, what are we supposed to see? And the connection is the ruling family. The Romans at this point, let me refresh your memory, first century ancient Near East, the Romans were an occupying force at this point. They ruled Palestine, they ruled the entire Mediterranean basin. And under Rome, who had the military on the ground forces there, commanded by a guy in Jerusalem named Pilate, you may have heard of him, that was the military leadership. The political side was actually ruled by this guy named Herod. He was technically the king of the Jews at this time. And his family, by the standards of traditional Judaism, the people he was supposed to be ruling, his family was messed up. I mean, I want you to understand how messed up they were. So take the Oedipus narrative, throw in a little bit of Oscar Wilde, and sprinkle in some King Lear. Oh, wait, y'all aren't laughing. Sorry. I've been in Boston. Sorry. Let me translate. Right. Okay, here we go. Take Keeping Up with the Kardashians, throw in a little bit of Duck Dynasty, and sprinkle in some Real Housewives, okay? That's this family. They are messed up. Herod married his brother's wife, and brother's quite alive. She's not a widow. And John the Baptist is like, are you kidding me? You can't do that. So he comes along with a very long accepted view of marriage and human sexuality, and all of a sudden he's narrow-minded and on the wrong side of history. Herodias cannot handle this challenge from John. She simply will not have it. Notice in verse 17, Herod imprisoned John because of Herodias. Verse 24, Herod executes John because of Herodias. This text is about her. And her reaction in verse 19 gives us insight into what she's thinking. She has a grudge, and it means exactly what you think it does. She is set against John the Baptist. And we can easily put ourselves in her shoes, or at least we can hear the voice of our culture in her shoes, right? No one gets to tell me how to live my life. Herod and I aren't hurting anyone. Stay out of our bedroom. It's none of his business. Who does John think he is? That sounds very familiar, doesn't it? I mean, John the Baptist has the audacity to look in from the outside and judge this marriage. They're not hurting anybody. Don't tell me how to live my life, she says. Sociologist Charles Murray calls this the concept of identity. Our culture says we create our own identity when we do what we want. No one gets to judge us based on our internal motivations. You do not get to speak an outside truth into my internal truth, because that's not real truth. This is. In other words, we are who we say we are in our culture. Now, girls and boys in the room, you may be like, what's a Charles Murray and what's identity? But you get this. You've seen this. Many of you have actually, okay, look at me, Pat, boys and girls. Many of you have actually listened to that great modern philosopher of identity, Elsa, from Disney's Frozen. Remember her song, Let It Go? I mean, who doesn't remember that song, right? Especially if you have daughters. What does she say? No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Let it go. And many of you could stand up and sing it right now. Please don't. That's enough of that song. But that's what we're talking about. That's our world. We get to say who we are. No one else does. That's why Herodias is mad and has a grudge against John the Baptist. He challenged her identity. He dared to question her. He triggered her. Just as Nazareth did to Jesus, just as Jesus says will happen to his disciples. Now, it's not my place, nor do I want to judge Herod or Herodias. That's not where the text goes. But here's the question. Does her self-given identity provide her the resources to respond well to challenges? Jesus is challenged and rejected, insulted on a very deep and personal level. And he has the fortitude to respond well. He anticipates his disciples being challenged and rejected. So he gives them the fortitude, the bandwidth to respond well. Does Herodias respond to challenge and rejection with fortitude? Or does she respond with weakness and insecurity? I mean, look at the text. What's the text say? Well, how's the narrative flow? It's not enough for her that John the Baptist is in her prison. She wants him gone. So check this out. Instead of the normal lewd dancers that were hired at these parties to come in and do what lewd dancers do for men, Herodias takes her own daughter in verse 22 and makes her be a lewd dancer. And in that patriarchal culture, by doing this public thing her daughter was about to do, she has sacrificed her daughter's virtue and reputation and made her unmarriable. She has completely sacrificed her daughter to manipulate her own husband. Because John can't just be silenced. He must be destroyed. She must have recompense for the offense because he spoke against her identity. And she can't respond well. She cannot tolerate John. She must destroy John. She can't coexist. Like the bumper sticker says, she has to destroy him because her identity is too fragile for real tolerance. She doesn't have the ability. She lacks the bandwidth, and so she has to destroy a different opinion. That kind of reaction is in my heart. I don't like it when people disagree with me. I don't like it when people have fundamentally different beliefs. But that reaction is not the person I want to be. Is that who you want to be? See, creating our own identity, being who we say we are, results in a fundamental insecurity in our heart, and we cannot abide challenges, and so we lash out. Herodias didn't have access to a Twitter feed, so instead she uses what she has to lash out at someone who disagrees with her. See, and that insecurity that we see in her, that we recognize in our own hearts, that insecurity is the main cause of oppression in our world and in human history. Whether it be the majority suppressing the minority, whether it be a nation oppressing its citizens, or whether it's in this text, one person with power doing it to another person without power, it's insecurity causing oppression. Is that the world we want? You see, our culture's idea that we can create our own identity puts us under enormous pressure to perform, to maintain that identity. We build our identity around our deepest desires and our deepest dreams, and if we don't achieve those dreams, we've failed somehow. See, when we name ourselves, when we become the source of our identity, our dreams become demands. Good things cease to be good, and they become vital for our identity. And it makes us insecure, mean, and petty because we have to protect these things. We have to achieve these things. We have to do these things. And if you hurt these things, I don't know who I am anymore. I can't tolerate you. I can't be equal with you. I have to protect this, and I will destroy you if you hurt my precious. That's what our culture makes us do. Jesus, on the other hand, notice, Jesus receives an identity. He doesn't achieve it. He receives it from who his Father says he is. Jesus' disciples receive an identity from who Jesus says they are. But in our culture, we don't receive an identity. We achieve our identity. And that makes us insecure, petty, unable really to love someone who fundamentally disagrees with us. And obviously, Herodias is not our contemporary. But we get a glimpse here of our culture's idea of identity in this text. I mean, think about who she is and what she's done. She has achieved Mrs. Herod. She is unquestionably, outside of Pilate's wife maybe, the most powerful woman in this part of the world. She is feared. Yet she was so insecure that she could not handle a small challenge to that identity, even if it was from some bug-eaten, hairy cloak-wearing recluse from the Styx that no one had heard of. She couldn't tolerate John's disagreement. Why? Because ultimately, we cannot give ourselves an identity. It doesn't give us the gravitas we need to live well in challenges. Again, sociologist Charles Taylor points out that in spite of what we claim, we are named not from the inside, we are always named from the outside. Whatever community we are aligned with, we like to wear MAGA hats and watch a certain news channel, great, that's who we identify with. We don't like to wear MAGA hats and we want to do something else, great. That's our identity. That community becomes our identity. So we do what these external things say to do. That's what it means to be a good person, to conform to this community. And so maintaining that standard becomes our identity. That's performance-based. We have to make sure everybody thinks we're doing it right. And it's fundamentally insecure. So we may claim we get to decide what the good life is. We may say, you don't get to tell me how to live my life. But ultimately, we want to be accepted by our community. So we adopt their standards. And we're very uncomfortable when someone has a different community and different standards, because what if we're wrong? It's easier to destroy them than it is to find out. And if you don't believe me, again, see your Twitter feed. You see, an achieved identity doesn't give us the fortitude to live well in challenges and rejections. it doesn't give us the resources to be tolerant or to build the accepting society we all want. But Mark shows us an alternative way. Now let's go back to verses 7 through 13 because there's one more thing happening here. The alternative way is this, is that Christians, the current disciples of Jesus Christ, are who Jesus says they are, not who they say they are. See, through the gospel, identity is received. It's not achieved. Our culture, rooted in the promise of the Enlightenment of humanism, says, hey, through rationality, through the scientific method, we can achieve cultural purpose and individual destiny. And that promise never came about. And that's not me saying that. That's the philosopher Nietzsche. Instead, what happens is this, as one of Nietzsche's students, Heidegger, pointed out, says, we live with this sense of being thrown into the world. It's this exhausting sense of directionlessness in life. He says this, by the time you wake up every morning, you're already there. Okay, and for those of you who just went, what? A young man at Florida State University named Jim Morrison was in his philosophy class one day, and he learned about Heidegger and this whole idea of thrownness, and he said, yes. And he resonated with that so clearly that one of the most popular songs The Doors ever put out, Riders on the Storm, has that line, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone. It's this idea of you just wake up and you're there. Maybe that's not getting it for you. Boys and girls, you have no idea what The Doors, Riders on the, Jim Morrison, none of that stuff. Let me help you, boys and girls. I want you to imagine every single day you're the new kid at school. It never gets better. So every single day you wake up, you don't know exactly where to go. You don't know exactly who your friends are. You don't feel comfortable in your skin because what if I do something wrong? That's the idea of thrownness. And adults feel it too. See, but what happens is Jesus comes along, and what does he offer in verse 7? Instead of our culture's idea of just being, just go, good luck, Jesus gives a specific, definitive sentness in verse 7. We receive an identity based on his mission for us. See, the gospel anchors our identity in the person and work of Jesus Christ. Instead of striving to achieve an identity that we have to defend, we receive an identity by grace, and it gives us the power to be the loving people we want to be because God puts his approval on us through Jesus, and so we can rest in that identity instead of constantly making sure our chosen community continues to approve us. See, when God tells us who we are through the gospel, he sets us free from performing and from insecurity. It gives us an internal strength. It gives us the resources to be the people we wish we were, leading to the society we wish we had. I mean, look at verse 11. I mean, this is striking. When Jesus' disciples encounter opposition, when they are confronted by someone who rejects their identity and objects to their mission, everything that's going to happen to Jesus, everything that happened to Herodias, I reject you, I reject everything you stand for. What does Jesus tell them to do? Does he tell them to call down fire from heaven and judge them? No. Does he rally them to make sure they get out and vote and stack the Supreme Court with the right kind of judges? No. Does he tell them to lash out and make them pay? No. He could have quoted Elsa again and said, let it go, but instead Jesus chooses to quote Taylor Swift and say, shake it off. Yeah, I said that out loud. You can throw something at me later. See, there's a strength in a received identity from Jesus. A strength that can say, we disagree, and it is seriously significant. But I still love you, and we can coexist. Your disagreement is not a threat to me personally. Isn't that the world you want? Isn't that the person you want to be? See, if you truly value tolerance and freedom and equality, the nobody can tell me how to live identity that we see in Herodias and that we live in our culture doesn't bring about that kind of world. It doesn't have the, it can't carry that freight. See, but Christianity provides the bandwidth to befriend and love those with whom we fundamentally disagree better than our culture does because Christians are rooted in identity given by grace. So we can handle people disagreeing because it's not about what we do. It's about what Jesus did for us and who he says we are. So just to wrap this up, by his life, death, and resurrection, Jesus has achieved an unshakable identity. When he was killed, and then when he rose from the grave, it confirmed everything he said he was. It confirmed that he was God incarnate. It confirmed that he was the special rescuer anointed by God. It confirmed that he was one with the Holy Spirit, empowered in ministry. Everything he said, his resurrection confirms. He achieved it, and then he gives it to us so we don't have to achieve that foundational identity. And by dying on the cross, Jesus jumped into our world and he experienced the directionlessness, the thrownness so much that even on the cross, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? I feel lost and alone for the first time ever. See, not only does he know what it's like to be directionlessness, like we do, but by his resurrection, he fixes it. And united to him, we can be delivered from that thrownness, from that directionlessness of life, and given a sentness, an identity based on who he says we are and what he has for us to do. When you place your faith and trust in Jesus, he names you as his own. He gives you an identity. It's like he says, hey, guess what? We're going to be brothers and sisters now, and my dad's going to be your dad. Come on, let's go meet him. And his dad embraces you and says, my child, you are mine. See, and from that place of strength, we can be the tolerant people we want to be, leading to the just society of equality we all want. That's real Christianity. That's the power of the gospel to change the world. And so if you fundamentally want to change the world for the better, Christianity has the resources to make that happen. So why don't you let Jesus turn you into that person? And you can have that world. Embrace him by faith. And that can be